Chapter 16 has been summarized for you in the previous lesson under four captions. Verses 1 to 4 was entitled Miserable Comforters, or subtitled How Not to Be a Counselor. And that led us to verse 5, which was captioned The Golden Rule of Counseling. And we spent a fair amount of time on verse 5, The Golden Rule of Counseling, because it has direct application for our Christian lives today. The third section is captioned Job's Tragic Plight, because at this stage, not only the world but God seems to be totally against him. And that takes up verses 6 through 18. We shall only cover verses 6 through 11. The reason being that in these sections and in chapter 16, the proper understanding depends so much on the proper understanding of the Hebrew, key Hebrew words in context. And if you read commentaries without the background knowledge, I can guarantee that you are going to be quite confused. So bear with me as we go through verses 6 through 11, Job's tragic plight. Though I speak, my grief is not assuaged, and though I forbear, what am I eased? But now he has made me weary, thou hast made desolate all my company, and thou hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me, and my leanness rising up in me beareth witness to my face. He, who is the he there, teareth me in his wrath, who hateth me, he gnasheth upon me with his teeth. Mine enemy, and who is that enemy is another question that has to be settled, sharpeneth his eyes upon me. And verses 10 and 11 go together. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. They have gathered themselves together against me. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. Verse 6, though I speak, my grief is not assuaged, and though I forbear, what am I eased? Sometimes it helps the understanding to go a little further and look not only at the meanings and context, but also the grammatical constructions used. And I highlighted these two expressions for you. I speak and I forbear. In the Hebrew, and there is equivalent in English as well, in the Hebrew they are in what is called the cohortative mood. In English, there are seven hortative moods, of which the cohortative is one. And these are grammatical terms. Why is that highlighted for you? Because the cohortative mood, both in Hebrew and in English, is used when the speaker wants to encourage the hearer either to do or to refrain from doing whatever action is going to be proposed in the following dialogue. So the cohortative mood, both in Hebrew and in English, is used to convey, in the first place, encouragement either to do or not to do. And indirectly, you can see that it is being used for special emphasis. In Hebrew, the cohortative mood can be either in the first person singular, as in this case, I speak, I forbear, But in English, the cohortative mood is always, almost always used in the first person plural. So the English equivalent belonging to the same mood would be signaled by this kind of expression, let us. And the construction of that, let us do something. Let us not go into the cave. Let us pursue the enemy. You can see that there is an encouragement, a drive to perform or not to perform a certain action. In this case, is that kind of emphasis appropriate? Though I speak, my grief is not assuaged. Though I forbear, what am I is? The natural emphasis falls on these two expressions. I speak, and I expect something out of it, and there's no result. I forbear, I control myself, and I expect some positive outcome. But there is no help. It doesn't lessen my grief. So the natural emphasis already is on that kind of expression, I speak, I forbear. And if you change the way it is expressed, you will completely undermine the force and the strength of that expression. Verse 6, the way it is given both in the Authorized Version and in the original Hebrew, conveys a very, very strong emphasis. Job's sheer frustration. I am pouring out all my troubles. I'm articulating all the sufferings I'm undergoing. I'm not claiming to be righteous, but I'm articulating my sense of being dealt a raw deal. And yet, my grief is not lessened. You can sense the sheer discouragement and frustration of the man. And he goes on to say, I could say more, and that would really lead me into sinful statements, accusing God, challenging God. But I hold back, I forbear, even though I am so grieved. And I expect that there is some easing of that pain, but it's of no use apparently. Therefore, this kind of grammatical construction brings out the natural emphasis in the whole sentence. You change that and you write it in the form that a newspaper reporter would write it, it becomes dead flat. There's no more force, no more drive to that verse. So the cohortative mood, if used judiciously, can convey to the reader or to the hearer the right kind of emphasis which the author wants to convey. So it really helps to be aware of not only meaning in context, but grammatical constructions as well. Which is why I did say repeatedly, this book of Job is next to Leviticus. Leviticus is highly technical, so it's difficult in that sense. Job is not highly technical, but because of the profundity of emotion being packaged and delivered, in my humble opinion, this is perhaps the most difficult book in the whole Bible if you want to understand it thoroughly. So pay attention to such things as grammatical construction. Back to the substance of what we are talking about. We have seen that this kind of emphasis is certainly appropriate for Job trying to express his sheer frustration that nothing seems to help. I plead, I pour out my troubles, I beg for relief. All my entreaties don't avail me anything. And I keep silent, thinking that maybe God wants me to shut my mouth. But even then, my sufferings continue. So Job says, I can only conclude that I am doomed to suffer and suffer in silence. So really, spiritually and emotionally, he is sinking almost to the rock bottom. And that leads in or ties in very neatly to the next verse. But now, he hath made me weary, thou hast made desolate all my company. You notice there is a sudden change in the personal pronoun. Who is the he that hath made me weary? And then it switches to the first person, thou hast made desolate all my company. If you read it and take it at face value, it doesn't mean anything, because who is the he and who is the thou? You might be tempted to think, okay, I apply the rule of nearest context. Who has just spoken before Job gives this monologue? You recall who was blasting him with criticism just before Job started to speak in chapter 15? It was Eliphaz. So if you say, okay, I'll apply the rule of nearest context, then you might think he has to be Eliphaz. And that, on the face of it, seems to be a natural conclusion. But then how do you account for the second half of verse 7? Thou hast made desolate all my company. Does Eliphaz have the power to make desolate, whatever the exact meaning may be? We get the idea of some profound, terrible tragedy or calamity. Does Eliphaz have the power to bring such calamities about? That question already tells us that the he in the first part of verse 7 is probably not referring to Eliphaz as such. No doubt Eliphaz, if you apply blindly the rule of nearest context, is the one who just before chapter 16 started had been blasting Job with a scathing but wholly misguided criticism. The only one who can make Job weary, and even if we don't immediately understand what the weariness implies, you do have an intuitive sense of some great emotional tragedy that has drained you, or in this case drained Job, of all his strength. And that really, there's only one agent who can bring about such devastation, emotional devastation, in the mind and heart of a human being. And that agent really is God. So the he in the first part of verse 7 has to refer to God. God as the causative agent has made me weary. What the weariness is, we come to just after this. And then it makes sense for him to switch to thou. It's almost as if in the first half of that verse, he is speaking to himself, muttering to himself. And in the second half of verse 7, he looks up in a figure of speech, seeing God standing before him, and then directly addressing God, you have made desolate all my company. So this kind of switching from singular pronoun to plural pronoun, from one subject to the next, adds to the difficulty of understanding the speeches, not so much of the three friends, they are fairly straightforward, but Job's speeches are full of these twists and turns, and one has to be extremely careful not to be misguided by what you read at first reading. So we are clear that in verse 7, Job is first of all referring to God, and then in the second half he's directly speaking to God. He's just so frustrated. He says, look, this is, you are responsible, are you not, Lord? for what has happened. The key to this is, what is the weariness that is referred, Job refers to in the first half of verse 7? As written for you there, the Hebrew is la'a, and it can refer to two types of weariness. It can refer to physical weariness, as when you undertake a taxing job, or, and this is more subtle, it can refer to psychological weariness. Best way to understand these two differences of usage is to look at other examples of scripture. So for an example of the first type of usage, physical weariness, I draw your attention to Jeremiah chapter 12 and verse 5, which makes it very clear what kind of weariness is being referred to. Jeremiah 12 verse 5, if thou hast run with the footmen, and they have wearied, wearied thee, then how canst thou contend with horses? So it could be physical weariness. Question to ask now is Job referring purely to physical weariness? Yes, he hasn't done any physical activity, but the sheer physical suffering, the illness, the disease, leave aside the emotional factors. I'm sure you can appreciate that disease or injury not only has an emotional toll, it has in the immediate sense a physical toll, particularly if that injury is of the kind that leaves you with a nagging, persistent pain in the joints. You will find that you can't sleep properly, and you will find that this constant pain, perhaps in the hip, in the knee, in the ankle, can actually nag away at you and leave you not just emotionally but physically weary and in no mood to do anything at all except sit in one place and stare into space. So the physical factor also has an emotional package to it, a payload to it. Is Job purely referring to the physical weariness brought about by his enormous pain and suffering? First question to ask. But if we say it is purely physical, then it doesn't fit the case of Job, because from what we have seen thus far, the bigger burden of the two, between the physical and the psychological, it should be apparent to us, is the psychological factor. So really, it's the psychological weariness that we now need to focus on. But again, to complicate matters, well, human beings are complicated to begin with. So don't be surprised if anything to do with a human being is seldom simple and clear-cut, particularly psychological factors. So when you talk of psychological weariness in the case of Job or of any one of us who might be undergoing suffering, it can take one of three forms. It can be a simple, straightforward discouragement. For example, Job chapter 4 verse 5, but now it, this suffering, is come upon thee, Job, and thou faintest. And again, the Hebrew word for faintest is the same for weariness, la'a. So it could be discouragement. On the other hand, the psychological weariness could be simply annoyance or irritation. Example would be again Job chapter 4 and verse 2. If we attempt to commune with thee, to talk to you and to counsel you, wilt thou be grieved, Job? Grieved again corresponds to the Hebrew la'a, which we take as weary in the context of Job chapter 16 verse 7. So the psychological weariness can be discouragement or annoyance, but it can also take the form of disgust. Example would be Exodus chapter 7 verse 18, where the Egyptians are said to be lost, disgusted, to drink the polluted waters of the Nile. Exodus 7:18, and the fish that is in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loth la'a, to drink of the water of the river. So the question is, which of these two forms of weariness, the physical or the psychological, which would be appropriate to Job? If you think carefully about all that he has gone through up to chapter 16, you would perhaps agree with me that in Job's special case, it is not a simple case of physical weariness or psychological weariness. Bear in mind that as a general rule, a rule of thumb if you like, physical weariness can occur without the emotional package going along with it. But where the emotional weariness is what is prevalent, you will invariably find there is also physical weariness. As we know, the mind and the body are so inextricably linked. And we sometimes jokingly say the mind controls the body, and it is really true in a very real sense. So where there is a psychological burden, it generally also carries some kind of physical package or physical overload factor. In Job's case, the intensity of both his emotional suffering when he lost his children, his servants, and all his wealth, his cattle, complete, and his sheep, and his camels, all gone. That was a tremendous emotional burden for him. But don't forget that Satan had been given wide latitude to deal with Job. Job to Satan was fair game except in one area, and that is his life. Everything else was laid open with no hedge of protection, and therefore the next phase of the satanic attack was the body of Job. So it is not just a matter of an emotional shock, emotional weariness to Job. There is now the physical burden that comes upon Job. And although the sickness, whatever it was, the boils on his body, the ulcers on his skin, whatever was the true medical basis of that disease, don't forget that the physical disease now brings about a psychological payload as well, which reinforces the original psychological factor that started this whole chain. So it's a tremendous burden. You start with a psychological problem, you continue and it becomes a physical burden, and the intensity of that physical suffering produces or reinforces the emotional factor, and you have a devilish circle going round and round, and the net effect is the human being is just brought down to total despair, almost to the point that he would want to commit suicide. That is the weariness that is referred to in this verse. It's a terrible feeling to experience. And Job is still, to his enormous credit, he is still holding up. But verse 7, deceptively short though it is, won't let us go, because we have really only tried to understand the first half of it. Now what about the second half we understand that the Tao has to refer directly to God. So Job has now switched from muttering under his breath. He now suddenly looks to God as if he could see God standing there, and he's addressing God directly. You, Lord, are the one who has made desolate all my company. What is he referring to in this second half? For that, we need to be aware of the key word, which is company. And it's written for you up on the whiteboard. The equivalent Hebrew word is Ada, and the literal meaning is an assembly or a congregation. The idea in the literal sense is any group of people who have come together at a pre-assigned time for a common purpose. So typically, this would be that kind of company, because we have come together at a pre-assigned time for common purpose. So typically it would be an assembly or a congregation. But that would not be entirely appropriate for the second half of verse 7. So the extension of that, the meaning of that word, would cover the household of Job. And this interpretation that Ada refers not to an external assembly, but to his immediate household, is strengthened by the fact of he referring to that company being made desolate. Do you remember that by the end of chapter 1, practically the entire household of Job, first it was the servants, then of course the sheep, camel and the cattle, but in terms of human lives, it was his servants who were knocked out, and then it was the children, all seven of them. So by the end of chapter 1, all Job had was maybe three servants. Remember, in each case there was one servant who escaped. So if there were three disasters, there would be three servants. So from his enormous household, all he's left with are three servants, his wife, himself, five people. So the entire household has been wiped out at one blow. And that is what he is referring to when he says, "You, Lord, have devastated my entire household." So that is the full meaning of verse 7. Why is he addressing God in the second half of verse 7? Thou. It's almost as if he is holding God responsible. From his perspective, that's all he can see. So we can forgive him for blaming God, because he was not privy to the dialogue that went on in chapter 1 and 2 between Satan and God. So he was not aware that the immediate causative agent of all his troubles was not the Lord God, but Satan acting within the bounds defined by God. But it is true that in a literal sense, God is responsible, because it is God who proposed the test. So was it unfair of God? It's easy to ask the question. It's also easy to answer the question. If we acknowledge that God is sovereign and that there is no higher power than Him, and if we don't acknowledge that, there is no religion to speak of. So if we acknowledge the absolute sovereignty of God, then the concepts of fair and unfair simply don't apply. Just like the concepts of yesterday, today and tomorrow, the time element, do not apply when we consider the nature of God. So the unique nature of God is such that many of the human constructs that we have, the flow of time, so that there is a yesterday, a today, and a tomorrow, don't apply to God. To God, everything is present and everywhere is before Him. So as far as God is present, every time and every place is here and now. So the concept of time or lapse of time doesn't apply. The concept of distance, far removed, near, doesn't apply. The concept of fair and unfair also cannot apply to God, except in this one simple sense, that God is always fair, He is always just, because that is the intrinsic character of God. Shorter Catechism asks this key question at the beginning: what is God? God is a spirit, eternal, infinite, eternal and unchangeable in His being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness and truth. So this is part of the intrinsic character of God: His justice, His goodness. And therefore, though it is true to say that the concepts of fair and unfair do not apply, we must immediately balance that by acknowledging that God, according to His own declaration or revelation of Himself, is always fair and always just. Therefore, we cannot support Job in saying that God has been unfair to him. And this would be helpful for us to bear in mind when we are put through sufferings and privations which we consider unjustified or unmerited, and we are inclined to blame God. Then it is helpful to remember the case of Job and to realize there's no basis for us to argue with that. We can plead for mercy, but in pleading for mercy, there must not be an undercurrent of bitterness or resentment against God, because God sees through the heart. It is no point, and you do not fool God by appealing for mercy when the unspoken thought in your mind and heart is, He's responsible anyway. He's the one who caused me to suffer like this. If you have that thought in your subconscious, it is immediately apparent to God. So your words may be very correct in the sense that you only plead for mercy, you are not arguing with God, but the unspoken thoughts in your heart are clear and audible to God. You are making that appeal on the basis that God is unfair, but you can't do anything about it. Therefore, the only thing you can do is to play on God's soft side and just appeal for mercy. That cuts no ice with God. You must be totally clear that when you ask God for relief, for mercy, it must be on the basis that you do not, even deep down, blame God or hold God responsible. Easy to say, enormously difficult to do, which is why we are given a lifetime to mature, to come to the stage where we can honestly express ourselves to God, either positively or negatively, without having this kind of undercurrent of resentment or bitterness against God. Verse 8, and thou, again we need to know who the thou is, has filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me, and my leanness, what is that leanness, rising up in me, beareth witness to my face. This is a particularly difficult verse, so I propose to break it up into two parts. The first part is this: thou hast filled me with wrinkles. As for who is the thou, I will discuss that when we come to verse 9, because that discussion will make it very clear who he is referring to. So I'll postpone that for the time being. Thou hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me. So our focus is, here is the physical evidence. There's something which Job calls wrinkles, which we are going to try and understand. And then we are going to try and understand, in what sense is this physical factor somehow connected with his appearance? How is that a witness against him? Again, we start off from the basics. Equivalent Hebrew word is kamat, which is a verb. It is used in the same sense in Job chapter 22, verse 16, where it is rendered to suit the context of verse of chapter 22, verse 16, where kamat is referred to as cut down out of time. This word wrinkle, kamat, has a wide spectrum of meaning. So in Job 22:16, I've given you one example which would not apply in verse 8 of chapter 16. But in chapter 22, verse 16, the same word, would the appropriate meaning would be cut down before time, prematurely cut down. But the same word could also mean to seize with the hands, to tie up, to bind up. The same idea as when the feet, the four legs of the lamb, are bound before it is slaughtered. It could also refer to the contraction of the pupil of the eye when a bright light is shone upon it. It could also refer to making rough the surface, to roughen. For example, someone who has spent a lot of time outdoors, an amateur sailor, is likely not only to have a sunburned appearance, but to have a very roughened, leathery kind of skin on the face and the arms. So kamat could also refer to that. So given this wide spectrum of meanings, how do we understand its usage in the first half of verse 8? If you think back to the kind of illness and the suffering Job is undergoing, you can imagine his face all screwed up and drawn up, and in sheer pain his body drawn together. Very often when a human being is undergoing severe physical pain, the knees tend to be brought up to the chest, and the whole human being is drawn together almost like a fetus. So this is the physical, the outward appearance of Job, given the severity of his physical ailment. His face rough, that is indicated by the wrinkles, and his whole body contracted as the pupil of an eye would be contracted. So this word in the Hebrew serves as a perfectly appropriate description, a very graphic description of Job, given the severity of his pain and suffering at this point in time. It is actually a very unnatural appearance for a human being. Now, if you bear that concept in mind, you will understand the second half of that verse. He says that his appearance of not only his face, but the disposition of his whole body and the appearance of his face is a witness against me. I mentioned that this appearance of a human being is highly unnatural. If you and I were to see a human being in such a contorted appearance and with such a drawn up face, it would not be surprising if we were to conclude that this person is under divine judgment. And this is the factor that Job is referring to. My physical appearance and the disposition of my body, all drawn up together, it serves as a witness against me, because on the face of it, this kind of unnatural appearance of a human being is easily mistaken for that person being under divine judgment. But Job says, I have all along been crying out that I am innocent. So this is my claim, I'm innocent. My bodily appearance, my facial features testify against me. They are a witness against me. So this is the meaning of the first half of verse 7. And indeed, if you remember the constant rebuttal by the friends of Job's claim to innocence is influenced by their seeing Job in this state and quite naturally but mistakenly taking that to mean a clear sign that this person is under divine judgment. So his appearance seems to be a witness against him. And of course we remember the injunction of scripture not to go by appearance, but what else can we go by? So we can't blame the friends. They could not see into the heart of Job. The second part of verse 8, and my leanness rising up in me beareth witness to my face. The leanness there is the Hebrew word kahash, which refers to literally a failure of the flesh. In other words, a wasting away of the flesh. In other words, an emaciation, the wasting away of the body. For an example of the usage of this Hebrew word kahash, look at Psalm 109 and the second half of verse 24. My flesh faileth kahash of fatness. So in the case of Job, his words are to be understood in this way. His present appearance, his wasted body, his emaciated body, his ulcerated skin does not do justice to his, does not do justice to him as a person, because the way he looks now is not his normal state. Therefore he is pleading with his friends, if you want to judge me whether I'm really a sinner, an unrepentant sinner or not, don't take my appearance at this point in time, because this is not my normal self. You can't use this exceptional appearance of mine as proof that I'm under divine judgment, because this would not be fair to me. This is not what I normally am. And that is a very fair argument. We can't judge a person by the exceptional aspects of his appearance or conduct. That person might be under some kind of duress, might be under some kind of stress. So if he or she appears to be irritable, we cannot conclude from that, oh, this person is a difficult person, keep away. We must always step back and look at whether the present behavior of that person is his or her normal behavior. So Job is saying, be fair to me. Don't look at me the way I am with my ulcerated skin. Normally, our skins are not ulcerated. Normally, we don't have boils all over our body bursting away and oozing pus. So if you were to see me in that condition, that is a highly unnatural state. Please don't take that as an indicator that I am under divine judgment. That's what Job is saying. Sadly, however, the friends, and we would make the same mistake, take his appearance as proof, and this is the meaning of the expression, beareth witness to my face, as proof of his apparent condemnation at the bar of divine justice. The real tragedy of Job's predicament is simply this. The evidence that he can present in his favor, if you want to call it that, the evidence speaks against him, because everyone in society automatically and justifiably, excusably rather, would assume that somebody with this kind of inhuman, unnatural appearance, almost like a demon, this person has to be under divine judgment. But Job cannot offer any real proof to counter that kind of conclusion. All he can do is keep on claiming, I have no unconfessed sin in my life. Believe me, whatever sins that I have had, I have always consistently dealt with it in the way that God has prescribed, by confession and by the sin offering. That is all he could offer. His word that he is innocent against the so-called evidence that people would go by to judge whether he really is under divine judgment or not. So that is the tragedy of his cry in verse 8. Thou hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me. They really are not a witness against him. And my leanness rising up in me beareth witness to my face. And wrongly, but unfortunately, people just go by appearance. They can't see my heart, they can't read my mind. Now we come to verse 9. And the he that is in verse 9, the discussion that follows would apply to the thou in verse 8. Who is he referring to in verse 8 when he addresses that person by thou? The argument would be derived from the discussion in verse 9. Who is the he? He teareth me in his wrath who hateth me. He gnasheth upon me with his teeth. Mine enemy, and that phrase is related to the he. So we need to consider these three key phrases. Mine enemy sharpeneth his eyes upon me. He teareth me in his wrath. He gnasheth upon me. Mine enemy sharpeneth his eyes upon me. Obviously, the he that Job is referring to is the person who is responsible for the violent actions that have been instituted against Job. Therefore, the he that he is referring to and the thou that he referred to in verse 8 can only mean one of three persons. So there are three possibilities which we have to consider and exclude one by one, and what is left finally by default would have to be the natural choice. Could it be Eliphaz? After all, Eliphaz was the spokesman for the gang of three that had come to commiserate with Job. That's the first possibility. Is Job referring in verse 9 and in the first half of verse 8 to Eliphaz? Or could it be a reference to Satan? After all, Satan is the archetypal enemy of believers. Could it refer to Satan? The third and only remaining possibility is God himself. If you look at it by human logic, if you ask me to go by human logic, I would pick the second, Satan. That appears to me to be the most logical. But in order to do that, and this is a useful principle to follow in Bible study, it is one thing to analyze it with our logical thought processes. But if we apply that here and say that it seems most logical that this person he's referring to in verse 9 is Satan, you notice that after chapter 2, there is no more direct mention of Satan at all, neither by the narrator, nor by God, nor by Job. There's absolutely no mention of Satan. That doesn't mean Satan is not at work. We know that he is at work in the spiritual realm and even in the physical realm behind the scenes. So if we are to ascribe the he that Job is referring to Satan, we have to inject into the text, we have to make presuppositions which are missing from the text, and that is completely inexcusable. It is not the way to do Bible study. Any kind of interpretation, however logical it may seem, that requires you to inject presuppositions which are not directly supported anywhere else in the passage, either the near or the intermediate context, that kind of interpretation must be dismissed at the outset. Otherwise, what is going to happen is, it's going to lead you into a highly speculative kind of Bible study. And if you particularly apply this technique to the book of Revelation, you can make those prophecies mean whatever you want it to mean, given the presuppositions that you injected into your Bible study at the outset. So any kind of interpretation that requires you to inject presuppositions must be identified and excluded at the outset. So on that basis, we exclude Satan. He is disqualified. Could Job be referring to Eliphaz? If so, then Eliphaz must have had the power to cause all these troubles to Job. But really, that would mean Eliphaz had to have the kind of power that is ascribed only to God. And how can Eliphaz, a human being, a mere human being, have the kind of power to bring this scale of disaster externally and internally to Job? So Eliphaz really is, like his other two friends, is only an onlooker. He is not an active agent in this whole process. So Eliphaz is excluded. Therefore, we are left by a process of elimination with the third possibility, and that is God. So it looks as if Job is referring to God as tearing him in his wrath, hating him, gnashing upon him like a wild animal, behaving like Job's enemy. To make that kind of interpretation, we have to check ourselves. No doubt, by a process of elimination, we have come to God. But because of what it entails to say that God is the person Job is referring to, because of what it entails, we have to have some more direct proof that that is the correct interpretation. And here we apply the rule of context. The nearest antecedent subject is indeed God, if you read that whole chapter. Therefore, we have to conclude, not just going by elimination, but by the rule of context, that Job is referring to God at this point in time for his understanding, at the level of understanding he has. Job is referring to God as the ultimate cause of all his undeserved affliction. And it is in that context that he uses the word enemy. In the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, the word enemy in Hebrew, sar, can have one of four meanings. It can mean narrow or tight. That doesn't apply in this context. It could be straight. It could be distressed. Doesn't apply either. It could be a hard pebble, hard as flint. Doesn't apply here. The fourth possible meaning, according to the standard lexicon, is adversary, foe, enemy, oppressor. So here, quite safely by elimination, the word enemy in the Hebrew refers to adversary, foe, or oppressor. This really brings us to the crucial point in the testing of Job. And what is that crucial point? The God whom he loved and worshipped, and whom he trusted implicitly, whom he looked upon as his friend, has that God now become my enemy? And this is the crucial point in his testing. If he now goes on to say, yes, that God whom I loved, revered, worshipped, and trusted as a friend, he is the one who is now my enemy, Satan would have won and Job would have lost. So really we are approaching the crucial point in the testing of Job. And in our lives too, there will be times when we may not realize it, but we will be led step by step to a crucial test, whether we proceed from that point and achieve greater things for God will depend upon how we face up to that test. This is a crucial moment for God. So we will stop here, continue next week.